Well, good evening. And sometime in the last week or so, someone asked me to give a talk on anger. And since it might be relevant for just a few of you some of the time, I would talk about it. Actually, I think that it's relevant for most people most of the time, since I think my impression is that most people most of the time have something to be angry about. It might not be, you know, active in their mind, but you know, some lingering there, kind of ready to come up if it need be. For some people, it has to do with politics. It's always ready there. Just bring up the word, and certain feelings of anger arise. For some people, it has to do with things at work. Some people have to do with things in their family, extended family. There's some great uncle, you know, who's just, or someone who's, you know, and it's, you know, something that that's, you know, ready at hand to be angry about. I think it's pretty pervasive, and it's something a lot of people are quite motivated or interested in learning with, or learning how to deal with, or do something with, partly because it can be so detrimental. It can be certainly be harmful to others, and it can be harmful to ourselves. And there's a saying in Buddhism, I think maybe other places too, that it takes, you know, it can take many, many years to develop a really good friend, but it can take just a few moments to ruin the friendship if you speak out of anger in a way that's inappropriate. And anger causes a lot of pain, but to be angry, and the results of anger when we act on it sometimes produces a lot of pain. And I know plenty of people who regret their angry deeds. And at the time it seemed right, at the time it seemed appropriate even, justified, but the consequences were such that they felt really bad about it afterwards. This is a small example I've seen in my own family is sometimes my older son using very strong words or strong language to get, basically say no. And then the two-year-old, having witnessed it, now wants to do the same thing. He wants to talk the same way, same tone of voice. And so some of anger, looking at my two-year-old, it's interesting to see the degree to which anger, some expression of anger, the appearance of anger, seems to be learned. And some of it seems to be, I don't know if innate is the right word, but just seems to kind of come with being a human being. Sometimes you can see the two-year-old mimicking what he's seen elsewhere, and as a way of communicating, a way of talking, a way of, you know, they mimic, they pick up from everyone how to be a human being. And if they see people being angry, then they think, well, that's how you're supposed to communicate. Just like that's how you say yes in English, by saying yes. You say, you know, if you want to communicate something, you do it through these particular vehicles of, or forms of anger that is picked up and learned. And some of it is, you know, seemingly innate. My two-year-old, it's quite something to watch him be frustrated at something, that he's not getting his way with something. And no one in our family has ever done this before, many generations as far as I know. He'll stand there in the kitchen floor and put his hands like this, and he'd take one foot and go... So I don't know where that's coming from, what he's channeling, but it seems, you know, almost like this, you know, primal expression of anger, frustration or something. And I remember once in the very beginning, when we had the San Jose sitting group, I was going down there regularly. I went down there once and I announced at the beginning of the talk that I was going to give a talk about enlightenment. It seems important for Buddhists, right? And so, but I said, before I give that talk, does anyone have anything they want to raise or question or some concern? And So we spent the rest of the time together talking about anger. You know, that's what was important to talk about, not enlightenment. And in some ways, that was pretty. It was good, I thought, that people are really interested in the practicalities of their life, what's really now, rather than something too idealistic. It turns out that in some of the ancient Buddhist texts, there's a lot of discussion about anger. So it's not just simply a modern concern, or a concern about our modern over-psychologized culture, but it's a concern. Anger is something that's, you know, human beings down through the ages and through many different cultures have had to deal with and work with, and Buddhists have been very concerned about how to work with it because it's so detrimental, not only in and of itself, but it can stand very much in the way of going very deep in practice. So especially one of the longest discussions about anger in the ancient texts is the longest discussion about loving kindness practice, where it really lays out how to do loving kindness practice. The biggest part of that big chapter on loving kindness practice, the bulk of it has to do with how to work with anger, because anger is a barrier towards love for loving kindness or kindness. And if you want to develop kindness, you need to understand the barrier. And as I like to emphasize a lot, whereas Buddhism has a lot of wonderful ideals, compassion, enlightenment, freedom, kindness, sometimes the wisest approach to the ideal is through the obstacle to it, through the which limits it, so what stands in the way. Because then it becomes also very realistic. You're looking at what stands in the way and then working with that and letting it fall away. And then what's on the other side reveals itself to you. But if you have an ideal that you're trying to live up to, sometimes people will kind of shape themselves artificially and inappropriately into some image of what they think the ideal is supposed to be like. But if you simply get rid of the obstacles, then your image of what it's like to be kind or loving, I mean, your image of what it's like to be might be very different than how actually you express yourself that way. And so to get rid of the obstacles rather than focusing on the ideals directly, I think is a time-honored Buddhist tradition. So to look at anger to understand how some of our things are very important. And so I would like to offer seven aspects or steps working with anger in all its different forms. You know, the anger has many different varieties and forms. And one of the most common questions that I've had when I've talked about the anger before is, what's wrong with anger? Isn't anger sometimes appropriate? And so I want to kind of address that up front. Working with anger, we need to learn to work with everything. Be mindful and present and free in the midst of all our experiences. And if we don't know how to be mindful and present and free in the midst of anger, as anger arises and happens, then we can't really be free. And if our justification of anger, I mean, if it was too quick to justify anger, the place of anger in our life, we might actually be inadvertently justifying being caught by anger, being a slave of anger, not being free. So the idea is, the focus on Buddhism is how to be free. And that's very important to say, because maybe not all anger is really terrible. But being caught is terrible. That's what Buddhism is about, is becoming uncaught. So even a wholesome anger, if there is such a thing, could take the form of being caught by that wholesomeness. And so how do we work with it so we don't get caught and trapped by the very expression of anger that might exist? So seven steps. And I have an acronym for these seven steps so that you'll remember. And if maybe you won't remember what the acronym stands for. But you remember the acronym, and hopefully it'll have some beneficial effects on you to remember the acronym. Because either it'll give you hope, there is some possibility, there is something else possible, or it'll make you smile at how silly it is. And so the acronym, the word is MADLISS. So from anger to MADLISS. How to go from anger to being at MADLISS. Not mad. So the first, the M, is to be motivated. And this maybe, you know, it's in many different situations in Buddhist practice, motivation is really the key. It's often said in Buddhism, everything rests on the tip of your motivation, of your intention. So to look at our motivations, clarify our motivations, be motivated is really important. And what's our motivation in relationship to anger? And that requires some getting to understand what our relationship to anger is. How do we relate to anger? What's the gut way we relate to it? Some people's relationship to anger is it's always justified. If I'm angry, I'm right. Some people's relationship to anger is it's always outwardly directed. So it's really something wrong in the world. Some people's relation to anger is that it's always inwardly directed. Some people's relationship to anger is that it's sinful and bad, and therefore I can't show it, I can't be it. It's something. Some people's relationship to anger is a proof that I am inherently weak and incapable, and then you feel even weaker. Or anger is a proof that I am, you know, out of control, or anger is proof I'm bad, or, you know, anger is... We have all kinds of things, the appearance of anger in our life. We have a relationship to that. And that relationship is interesting to try to understand, because that relationship influences our motivation in relationship to it. So if we think anger is really bad and embarrassing, our usual motivation is maybe to hide it or repress it. Or if our usual relationship to anger is, I believe everything I think, therefore if I'm angry, the anger must be true, then we feel I can just kind of let it rip, it's no problem. Or if my belief around anger, my reaction to anger is fear, or many things. So to look at what it might be. And then, if you reflect on your motivation, your relationship to anger, are there wise ways of relating to anger? And are there wise ways, not your usual way of relating to anger, but ways you'd like to relate to anger? Because if you're motivated not to be angry, or motivated not to express anger in hostile ways, or if you're motivated to learn from your anger, or if you're motivated to find a way not to be caught by your anger, those are really healthy motivations to have. And to have those motivations be stronger than your motivation to swear at the sucker, that guy, that jerk, or whatever. So, and that's really important to get our motivation strong, because it's when anger is really flowing strongly, it has a way of being self-perpetuating, self-absorbing. And it's very hard to get out of it and see out of it. Even though you might have a little whisper in the back of the mind that says, this is not good or not right or something, but the inner stories, the way we talk to ourselves, the feelings, the emotion, the energy, is just kind of like carrying us along, and we lose sight of anything else. So to have reflected thought, even maybe when we're not angry, it's the best time to do this. Go for a long walk when you're really in good shape, and to go up, for a long walk on Windy Hill or something, and say, okay, this is going to be my time to think about anger. And I'm not angry right now, but I'm going to reflect on my history with anger, how it's been in my family, what I learned from my family growing up, the attitude our family had about anger. I'm going to learn about my life experiences with anger, and I'm going to learn about the different experiences I've had with expressing anger, living with anger, being the recipient of anger. Kind of do a life review around anger, and really look at anger and see if in doing all that you can come to some really strong motivation about how in the future you want to work with anger, resolve it, clarify it, deal with it. So when you have access to wisdom, work on your motivation. Some people who are motivated to work on their anger are only motivated when they're angry and in pain. But I'm suggesting it's very important, if anger is something you want to look at in your life, spend some careful time looking at it and your relationship to it and how you're motivated in relationship to it at a time when you're not angry, when it's distant, and do this kind of work. So look at your motivation, work on it. Because if the motivation is strong enough to do something healthy in relationship to anger, then when your anger arises strongly, that motivation might kick in and help kind of keep you from getting sucked in too far, getting caught too much. So motivation is really important. The second is attention, mindfulness. So to learn to pay attention to it. And that means developing skills of attention, motivation to pay attention. knowing how to pay attention. So a lot of what we teach at IMC about mindfulness has a lot to do with this issue of how to pay attention, what to pay attention to, and developing our capacity to pay attention. Attention is like a muscle. Mindfulness is like a muscle. And you can develop that muscle. If the muscle is weak, you're not going to be able to use it in crisis. But if the muscle is strong, it's going to be available in crisis. And you know what to do. You know how to be mindful. You know how to bring a kind of attention to the experience where in the attention itself, you're not caught by the experience, or you're a little bit separated or removed from the experience. So again, this depends partly on what you do before you get angry, cultivating and developing your capacity for attention and awareness. So looking at your, developing your capacity to be attentive, learning when you're angry, what to pay attention to. Generally, it's very helpful, I find, to pay attention to my body, to the flow of the energy in my body. I find it very fascinating because many people have said anger can either be outwardly directed or inwardly directed. Some people's default is outwardly, some people inwardly. Something's wrong, they're to blame. Something's wrong, I'm to blame, of course. But a very interesting possibility with mindfulness or awareness or attention is to have the energy of anger be neither outward or inwardly directed, but have it just flowing within your system. It's like mindfulness becomes the holder, the container for it. Or it's like, if there's not proper attention or mindfulness, there's this built-up charge. And when it's going to be pushed out through two narrow channels. That's part of what's going to be painful, it's a constriction around it. It's either going to go out or it's going to go in. But mindfulness is like making this space in the heart, or space inside the body, where the energy can flow without being directed through these two little holes that build up the charge. And so to learn the capacity to hold anger in your body, it's great, it's fascinating. Just sit still, close your eyes. Next time you have a really good anger situation, I mean, look, don't make this, make yourself angry, but look for the opportunity. There it is. Or maybe even have a partner or friend who can say, look, now's the time. Remember what Gil said to this? You know, because you might not remember to do it on your own, but if somebody else might say, hey, this is the time to do it. And then just sit down and close your eyes and go for a ride. And just feel what's going on in your body. It's like the rodeo sometimes. And just feel the coursing of restlessness and agitation and energy and, you know, and all these different feelings and energies in your body. And see what it's like not to direct it in any direction, but just let it course through your body. It's really great. And meditation is a great place to be angry. Because meditation is maybe the safest and only place in human life where you have unconditional permission to feel what you're feeling. Anywhere else you go in society, some things, you know, sometimes it's okay, sometimes it's not. You know, if you're at someone's wedding, you know, and they're smiling and happy and they're just about ready to do their kiss, and you remember what your boss said at work yesterday, you don't yell, you know, something out loud, you know, let your anger rip at that moment. It's not appropriate, right? At that beautiful moment of the wedding, right? There's always, and there's nuances of how much emotions you need to be modulated in different situations. It's normal in life. But in meditation, you don't have to modulate or repress or hold back, or, you know, you just let it kind of, you don't have to act on it either. Meditation is not acting on anger, but just, you know, letting it be, letting it, it's great. You have permission. So you can also just do that, you know, if you have a few minutes quiet time in your daily life, just sit and close your eyes, sit in a chair and just let it go. So learning the capacity to let it go like that, to learn what it feels like in your body and the energy, it's really good. To learn to pay attention to the impulses that come out of you when you're angry. Sometimes people, when they're angry, act impulsively. But learn to track impulses, to feel what it's like when your voice wants to say something. To feel what it's like when your arm wants to, your hand wants to clench. To feel what it's like when your hand wants to go, you know, at someone. It's really great. The last time I really wanted to punch someone out was in a Zen meditation hall in Japan. It's a strange place to want to punch someone out. It was in Japan, and it was the guy next to me in the hall. It was very, very immediate. And he was doing all this stuff that was provoking me. I mean, he was really, he didn't like me. You see, he was one day more senior than me in the monastery. And seniority is really important. And I can tell you all these stories about this guy. And and what it was like to be next to him. And I can remember the feeling in my arms, you know, and the feeling, you know, I was sitting and I couldn't move. And Zen, you can't move, right? But the feeling, you know, coursing down my arms, and the feeling in my wrist, and the voices and the thoughts. It's like, you know, just the feeling. I just wanted to belt this guy. You know, you feel all these things. It's quite fascinating to feel all this kind of stuff. But to feel that impulse, you can feel the impulse. Now, you can feel an impulse really well. The impulse doesn't have to be translated to action. And that's part of the power of attention, is you have more than choice around your actions when you can feel an impulse and then not act on it. Attention is really important. Sometimes the most useful thing about attention is simply, you know, you're angry when you're angry. That can change situation dramatically, to know you're angry when you're angry. So the first is motivation. The second is attention. The third, for D, is diffuse. Diffuse your energy. You might not, if the anger is strong in you, the fury, the ire, the rage, whatever, the resentment is strong enough, it's possible you're not going to think very clearly. It's possible that your motivations are not going to be so helpful. And it's possible the most helpful thing you can do when you're angry is to somehow reduce the anger energy, diffuse it, cool, get cool, calm down. Now, there are many ways of doing that. One way is to go for a walk, another way is to take a nap, lay down. Some people like to meditate, some people like to take showers, some people like to go for a run, some people like to talk with someone or talk it out with someone. Let me call up a friend and say, I need to talk to someone. There's many ways that people like to kind of diffuse, kind of clear the air, clear their mind a little bit, so the anger doesn't have the grip of them. It's important that each person find what works for them, or a variety of ways that works for them. And so to find some way to make space, so we're not kind of in the grip of it. Doesn't mean that we're now one of the tricks around this, about diffusing it, is not to diffuse it to such a point that you can forget what the issue is, or the problem. And you know, if you just kind of calm down, but the original problem is still there, then, and you don't address it, you don't deal with it, I don't think that's healthy. You know, if you can, if it's appropriate to deal with it. I know some people cool themselves down and then just kind of are in denial. But, you know, find somebody to diffuse what's going on. And, you know, at times I've gotten angry, one of my common ways is to go for a walk. And I find the walk a really important time for me to do the next step of the acronym, and that is to learn. So look at your motivation, develop your attention, diffuse. This yourself, diffuse the situation, diffuse what's, maybe the other person's angry, you can maybe help them kind of calm down without, in such a way they don't want to punch you out. But diffuse the situation, diffuse yourself, and then learn. This is really important. Really learn what's going on. Try to understand what happened. And I know sometimes, remember I used to live on Skyline and I would be angry and I'd go walking in the woods up there. And I would just let it be, the anger. You know, we just kind of made space for it. And that space was kind of a diffusion, but I didn't try to get rid of it. But I just kind of let my thoughts be what they would do. I tried to figure out what's going on here and be with it and be present. And I tried to understand what was the nature of the phenomena. Because generally, anger is not a single thing. It's an aggregate. It's a composite. It's an ecology. It's many different things. There's many different forms of anger, many different causes of anger. There's many different objects of anger. There's many, anger is such a huge, huge, diverse phenomena. And to think you understand anger because you understand one kind of your anger is to not do it justice. There's so many different kinds, ways it expresses itself and manifests itself, and reasons for it. So to begin to learn, how is it today? What is this anger like? What's there? What's happening? One of the things I've taught about often is I find it very helpful to realize that often anger had roots, underlying causes for why the anger was. The anger was a symptom, not a cause of the problem, or not a, you know, more at the root. And the root for me was often either being hurt or being afraid. And if I could understand the root of fear or hurt, then I could go back to talk to the person that was involved and have a very different conversation than if I said to the person, I'm angry with you. That, you know, allows for a certain kind of conversation. But if you go back and say, when you said X, I was really afraid, or I felt really hurt, then it's a whole different conversation. And because generally when you say that, people will kind of, you know, they're not being attacked. And they realize, oh, I said that, that had that effect on you? Generally people don't say, oh good, that's what I was trying to do. They'll say, oh, you know, oh. So to learn what's going on. Is it connected to frustration? Frustration is often frustrated expectation or frustrated desire. Are we carrying ourselves into the world in such a way that we're set up to be triggered? Some people don't realize that before they got angry, they were kind of like a... They were, you know, wired. They'd wired themselves so that the slightest little thing would just trigger them in a big way. Or it could be a big thing would trigger them. But to understand what was going on with you before you got angry. It can be a hard study to do. Begin looking. What was happening before? Did you walk around the world with an expectation that in California the trains run on time? Mm-hmm. Is that an expectation you had? If most people to go, there's some countries in the world where you go, and no one in their right mind would expect the trains to run on time. You know, it's just not an issue. You know, it's just like, you know, the train's an hour late, you know. Well, you know, of course it's an hour late. That's why we brought lunch with us. But, you know, we have the expectation. We expect things to work a certain way, perhaps. Is it necessary to carry that expectation? And we could have thousands of expectations that are so subtle that we think that they're part of the natural world, that things work this way. We don't realize we're carrying an expectation. Often expectations go along with desires. We have a desire. So we want to take Caltrans because we want to get to SBC Park in time. Because, you know, the Giants are doing really bad this year, which is a reason for being angry. And you want to go there to the stadium and let them know. Or let that pitcher know. So I know some people, you know, boo certain pitchers, I've heard. And so you want to participate in that. And so you have the desire to get there, but Caltrans is not on time. So the desire is frustrated. And so the question is, how do you hold your desires? Maybe more important than looking at anger is to look at what's your relationship to desires. Some people's relationship to desires is, if I want it, it's right. It's appropriate, it's needed, it's expected, it's the natural order of the universe that my desires are fulfilled. Not all my desires. I know that certain desires are just unrealistic. I know that wanting a Ferrari is unrealistic. You know, I know that. I'm wise enough to that. But these small desires, you know, they're reasonable. That the computer works. See, some people are wise. Some people don't get angry because they know they don't expect it to be angry to work. So to learn what's going on with us, what's happening with us, how are we holding ourselves, learning our own psychology, learning our common tendencies, to study ourselves. It takes work to learn. So motivate, attention, diffuse, learn. The next one is empathy. Many times when we're angry, empathy or compassion is a very important element that can be very helpful. And often I think it's helpful to have compassion for ourselves. I think it's really hard to be a human being. Maybe it's always been hard to be a human being. Every society and culture in different times has different stresses on what it's like to be a human being. We have our own in our culture. But it's, you know, human life is often very difficult and challenging. sickness, old age, and death takes all its many forms in our lives. And we have sometimes in our society a certain level of ideal of perfectionism. No one in the history of humankind, I would venture to say, has had to make so many different choices about their lives as people have to do in the modern world. It used to be that you were born, you knew what you were going to do the rest of your life. You followed in the family lineage, the business, the work. You farmed, you hunted, you know, whatever you did, and it was just known. That's what, you know, there wasn't a lot of choices. You know, your parents married you off, and that was it. You know, and you had kids, and you know, there was no choices about whether you should have kids or not, or whether or not to get married, or who to get married to, or what kind of work to do, or what kind of house to buy, and what kind of paint to put in your kitchen, and which kind of contractor to hire, and you know, and how to choose which contractor, and you know which yellow pages to look in, and which friends to trust for their advisor and a contractor, and you know, we have so many choices. You know, we go to the market and look at all the choices we have, and you know, this idea of we're all supposed to be capable and competent and manage so many different things. I think that the level of expectation on what how we hold ourselves. And what we expect of ourselves is too high for many people. So to have compassion for what we're up against, compassion for ourselves, to feel our suffering when we're suffering, when we feel our suffering when we're angry, to feel how our anger arises out of our suffering, to feel how our anger arises out of the stress we're living. Part of the learning is to learn how easy it is to be angry when we're stressed out. And stress is one of the prime conditions for anger. And so maybe more important than working with anger is to work at our level of stress we carry with us. Find some way to de-stress. So the diffusing, de-stressing aspect is very important. So have compassion for ourselves. In some situations when we're angry, it's important to have empathy or compassion for the other people. You know, often when we see people through the filter of our anger, we see them in a very narrow view of who they are. But maybe they're not how we think they are. Maybe they're different. Some time ago, I read a study about anger. And they talked about a movie they showed bus drivers in New York City. It was it was a movie about how certain irritating characteristics passengers had was the symptoms of disabilities that they had. These various kinds of disabilities can manifest in certain kind of odd behavior. And so one bus driver said that before the movie, whenever someone rang the stop button 5 times, you know, his response was to take them 5 extra stops. But now he realizes the person might have some kind of chronic anxiety disorder. And it's a manifestation of a real disability, anxiety disability, the bus driver has empathy for them. So to start understanding that people's difficulties and quirks and challenges in lives and how they are, maybe comes out of their stresses, their difficulties in life, and then it kind of changes the context. And we realize that the reason our boss was a jerk to us was not because he or she is an inherent jerk, but because maybe his mother is dying at home and he can't afford to take time to be with her properly and no one else is there to take care of her properly, and it's just a horrible situation. I know someone recently who, not a boss, but is trapped in a bind between having a job and not losing it and a mother who's dying and not being able to take care of both of them. It's a very, very painful situation. Tremendously stressful. And when people find themselves in that kind of stressful situation, they behave in ways that can be difficult for others. A great story that I told maybe too many times of Norman Fisher accidentally, unknowingly, took a parking space someone else had his eye on. That's pretty bad, right? They were lined up, ready to take it, and he's pulled in. So the person jumped out of his car, ran up to Norman, and started yelling at him, you know, really letting him know how terrible that was. Really angry. Now, you have to be very wise, very wise, how you use the next thing, how you say what Norman said to this person. Now, don't just take this as like you can go say this to anybody and how he's angry with you. could be very wise. So Norman's a very wise man. So he said to the guy after a while, after listening for some time, he said, "Oh, you're having a really hard day today, aren't you?" And the guy's shoulders dropped, and he said, "Yes, I am." And then they were able to kind of talk and kind of connect in a different level. Empathy. Norman had the ability to see what was going on and to feel some compassion and concern for it. So empathy. Where's the empathy? And are we motivated to be compassionate? Are we motivated to look for compassion? It's part of the whole motivation part of it all. Is our motivation for compassion greater than a motivation to be right or to get revenge? So empathy. So we're near the end. So SS. So my madless. So the first S is story substitution and story supplementation. So story supplementation is kind of like, you know, you realize, kind of part of the empathy, you realize, oh, there's more to the story than meets the eye here. This person's having a really hard day. And that's part of the story too. Or this person has some kind of Tourette's syndrome, you know, or this person has some kind of issue, and or this person, whatever. Or this person's a human being. Shouldn't that be enough? You know, to relax a little bit around that. And so somehow supplement the story, you know, with big, more information. What else is going on here? But sometimes substitution is helpful. You know, you have one little piece of evidence of what's going on. Your story you're making up. Can you make up a different story that fits the evidence? Or two or three different stories that fits the evidence? And you realize the story that you had of what's going on maybe isn't true. Maybe it's true, maybe it's not. So you can hold it lighter. We'll see. So you've told someone it's really important they don't come late to a meeting again. They come late a few times. That's how it really triggers your feelings of being disrespected, and how it's really important they don't come late again. And you're waiting at the corner, and you had a 2 o'clock appointment, and 2:30 they're not there, 2:45 they're not there. You finally give up. You're furious. This person, you know, is disrespecting me one more time. I even told the person about it. And then you find out the next day or that evening or sometime the person was on the way to the meeting, was not only going to be on time, was a little bit early, but was rear-ended and now is in the hospital with, they don't know if the neck's broken or not, but they'll find out in a few days. And suddenly your anger, you realize how much your anger was a story you told yourself. It's a way that we talk to ourselves, self-talk. And so it was a story you created, and you held on to the story. You didn't have the real evidence. It was an interpretation. But we hold on to that interpretation. This is the true interpretation. Until we have the evidence, hold your interpretations lightly. And then, you know, maybe it's a good interpretation to keep. And then when the person shows up and says, "Oh, when you didn't show up, this is one interpretation I had. Was that accurate?" And the person says, "Oh, yes, I was disrespectful." Or, you know, or they give you an excuse that sounds pretty lame. Or they say, "Yeah, you know, see this neck brace? I was on my way." I've been in situations where I was angry with someone only to find out later, you know, whole new information, and just anger is diffused. How much of our anger arises not out of the situation, but out of the way we talk to ourselves, self-talk? If you study your anger and what's going on with your anger, you'll find that one of the very gripping aspects of anger is the self-talk that goes on. The stories you're telling yourself. You're walking around your house kind of fuming. And listen, you see all these stories and repeating yourself. And sometimes the best thing to do is, again, the diffusing thing, is to find some way to cut through the story making of the mind. And one of the ways, you know, is people have the ability to get concentrated. Just count your breath. Somehow find some way to step out of the story. Quiet the storytelling of the mind. So story supplementation or story substitution is a very valuable skill. It turns out that in the ancient Buddhist texts on anger management, this was actually a big part of it. Empathy and and story substitution, understanding it in a different way. One of the ways of understanding anger in a different way is kind of understanding that this works for the ancients. It doesn't work for us, maybe. To understand that when you're angry, you're ugly. Angry people are ugly. That's what they said in the ancient world. And we do spend a tremendous amount of money in the world, in America, on beautification. So maybe we're somewhat motivated not to get ugly by being angry. Another one is to realize the pain, something about the nature of the suffering, or the kind of suffering that anger is. And one of the ways, they kind of substitution kind of thing, story that the Buddha suggests, is when you get angry with your enemy, you're doing your enemy a favor. Because your enemy can only harm you physically. But only you can hurt your heart by the way that you relate to your heart, the way you pick up something, the way you react and respond. And so you're doing your enemy a favor. And if you don't react to your enemy, someone gets angry with you, is furious with you, and you just stay calm and cool, then you're just witnessing your enemy hurting himself. Now, you don't want your enemy to hurt, I know, but still, that's what you're witnessing. So this kind of, you know, that's kind of the strategy the ancient Buddhists used, among other things, to help them kind of deal with their anger. And then the last one, and maybe it shouldn't be last in what you do, but maybe it's good sometimes to keep near the end. All these different first six steps have to do with anger management. So you come to the last step, very important, and this is speaking. And speaking is shorthand for acting, doing something. Anger is always a symptom that something is a problem. It's always a symptom that something is a problem. Sometimes the problem is in the world out there. Sometimes the problem is in here, inside yourself. Sometimes it's somewhere in between, if there is such a place. But anger is a symptom that something's a problem. Even if, you know, if the anger is unreasonable, if the world is actually just perfect, but it's our crazy way of reacting to it, it's still a symptom that something's wrong. I'm crazy. You know, so I'm kind of misunderstood something. I have a certain issue around anger or certain expectations or attachments. Anger is always a symptom that should be taken seriously. It should never be dismissed lightly. You should never try to get rid of it and not try to learn the lessons of it. It's always a lesson there. I think, generally, a wise place to go for the lesson, the first strategy, is to go inside ourselves. What is a lesson? What do I have to learn about myself in this situation? Why am I being triggered? What are the triggers inside of me? What are the conditions inside of me? It doesn't mean we turn a blind eye to what goes on externally, but it's often a wise place to begin. And then to speak means if a problem needs to be addressed, address it. Go talk to the person. Say, you know, I need to talk to you about something that happened yesterday. Or I need to confess about certain difficulties I have. I need to share with you a little bit that, you know, I got angry. And I reflected about it, but I was, you know, I don't think you did anything wrong, but I need to at least tell you and apologize. Or I'm struggling right now. I remember once being angry with the chair of the department when I was a graduate student. And I was just working as a TA for him. And it wasn't usually the person you should be angry with. He was kind of like your boss, right? But he was being inappropriate. And I was really angry. And I felt like, with this kind of anger, I don't think... I felt that, you know, I have to do something. I have to go talk to him. The nature of this anger, I have to talk to him. But, so I showed up and I made I statements. I basically said, when you said that, this was my response. This is what happened inside of me. And I was visibly kind of just shaking a little bit. It was that strong. And because I wasn't attacking him, I was just kind of laying out what had happened to me, he actually took it really well. And we were able to have a working conversation and kind of figure out something for the future. And but to speak, talk about what's going on. And it takes a lot of wisdom, it takes a lot of skills to know how to talk, especially if someone else is being difficult. To learn those skills, but to begin by learning about ourselves, the first part of Madhless, to learn all those things. So it's 9 o'clock. I don't want you angry with me. Going on and on. And so 7 steps. Motivation, attention, diffuse, empathy, learn, empathy, substitution, and speaking. And maybe the last thing I'll say, maybe it's the climax of the talk, maybe it's anticlimax. I meant to say it earlier. Maybe learning about yourself. I've read, this is not, I don't have the empirical evidence for what I'm about to say, but I've read great spiritual teachers say this, and I've read psychological studies about anger that claim that in their studies and people, kind of clinical studies, that this is the results they saw. They saw that the degree of hostility that a person carries with them through life is directly connected to how selfish they are, self-absorbed, self-involved. So to look at anger, look at hostility, and if it's a regular phenomenon, maybe part of what needs to be looked at is how we hold ourselves and how we relate to ourselves as a self. Are we always looking at ourselves, me, myself, and mine? The word, the psychological study used the expression me, myself, and mine. People, they listened to different people talk about, they put people in frustrating situations, and they listened to how they talked. And the people who used a lot of me, my, and mine in their conversation were the ones who expressed the most hostility. And to look at, what's a self-talk? How do you talk to yourself? Is it mostly about the self-involved? It's all about yourself. And how is it involved with yourself? Such a degree that you kind of lose touch with others? Do you think you're right? How is that sense of self, self-attachment, self-identity, related to the anger we carry with us, hostility? So I hope this was an adequate talk. The whole topic of anger, it's a universe. No one could do it justice in 40 minutes, 45 minutes. But my hope is, in talking about it, that you become interested and motivated to investigate your particular universe and how it manifests and works in your life. Thank you.